and he frowned. Since the recent attacks, the Chosen had allowed some of the more faint-hearted nobles to come and stay in one of the castle's many guest rooms, but in the wake of Olimon's death, the woman had apparently decided to seek safety elsewhere. Watching the little girl drug past by her mother, Alesh thought of Sonya, and that made him think of the reason he'd come back in the first place. Kale and Phelan Parr walking through the poor district. Despite what Kale had said, they hadn't seemed like two men negotiating to him. They had seemed like two men on a mission, two men with a lot on their minds. Besides, if Kale's intention had been to win the leader of the Redeemers over, as he'd claimed, wouldn't he have chosen a wealthier side of town? He knew the Chosen's apprentice well enough to know this would be true. He would have wanted to host Parr in his family's manse, with servants scurrying to and fro at his every command. So why, then, would he have met him in the poor district? Alesh could think of only one reason. To hide. He decided that he wanted to ask the Chosen's apprentice a few more questions. If nothing else, it would give him something to do, something to keep the grief back for a little while longer, at least. Chapter 16. He asked a passing servant where he could find Kale, and the man, wiping at his eyes and sniffing loudly, managed to tell him that Kale was preparing to give a speech in the audience room. Once again, Alesh was overcome with the feeling that he was running out of time, that some invisible clock was ticking down to what? Ridiculous, of course. The Chosen was dead, and no amount of hurrying could change that. He hurried anyway. Four guards, wearing the white and gold colours of Olimon, were positioned outside the massive double doors, and one of them, a bearded man with eyes so dark that they were nearly black, held up a hand as he approached. Alesh noticed, absently, that it was bandaged.
"Stop where you are."
Alesh glanced up at the man, and was surprised to find that he didn't recognize him. In fact, he only recognized one of the four guards. Strange, considering that he'd been living at the castle since he was a child, and had thought he knew all the guards by name. "I'm sorry," he said, "but is Kale in there? I have to talk to him. It's important." The man sneered.
"The Chosen ain't got time to waste on servants. In case you haven't noticed, boy, the city's in a state of crisis, or soon will be once the commoners find out what's happened." "But I have to—" "Leave, boy," another of the guards growled, "before we make you. You wouldn't like that, believe me."
Alesh turned to the guard he recognized, an older man with a short, neatly trimmed grey beard.
"Erwin?" "Best do what they say, Alesh,"
Erwin said in a gruff voice.
"You'll have a chance to talk to Loranian."
He paused at a look from one of the guards.
"To Chosen Loranian, after he's finished giving his speech."
Alesh stared at the man in surprise.
"But Erwin, go!"
Alesh took an involuntary step back at the anger in the man's voice. He'd known Erwin for years, since he'd first come to the castle, had often sat and talked to the older man about his daughter and his grandchildren. Erwin had always been kind to him in the past. What had changed? Never mind that. Chosen Olimon's throne room is always open to any who wish to speak with him. The first guard who'd spoken stepped forward, reaching for the truncheon hanging at his side.
"I've had about enough of this boy's blather. Now—"
Erwin stuck out an arm, forestalling him.
"I'll handle this," he growled.
The man frowned at the hand on his chest, but made no move.
"Olimon's dead, boy," Erwin said,
meeting Alesh's eyes for the first time.
"Dead and gone, and there are going to be some changes. If I was you, I'd get out of the castle. We don't need you here now."
He took a step closer, a grim expression on his face.
"Do you understand, boy? You need to go."
Anger ran through Alesh, anger at these men who dared to counteract Arliman's ordinances when his corpse was not yet cold, and a wild, almost irrepressible urge came over him to charge them, to rend and tear and rip, to see their blood bright and red and— He swallowed hard, shaking his head as if to clear it. Where had that come from? He forced himself to take a slow, deep breath, rubbing absently at his shoulder, where the scar had begun to burn uncomfortably. "Fine," he managed through gritted teeth. "I'll go." He glanced once more at the entrance to the audience chamber, before turning and stalking off. He wouldn't be getting to Kale through that door. But then, he thought, smiling grimly as he turned the corner, servants rarely take the main entrance. In a short time, Alesh was in the servants' corridors, the tunnels that ran throughout the castle like veins through a man's body, only these veins didn't carry blood, but men and women going about their master's errands. Here, no expensive rugs lay on the floor, no elaborate tapestries and paintings adorned the walls, and no guards stood watch. Such things were reserved for nobles and visiting dignitaries, not servants. The plain stone beneath his feet and on the surrounding walls was covered here and there with thin layers of dust. Those who would have cleaned them, much too busy doing the bidding of their masters to worry about the cleanliness of a corridor only they used. Footprints in the film of dust on the floor showed where servants had traipsed back and forth in answer to their master's bidding. Alesh himself had used the corridors nearly every day for the past 15 years, running errands for his own master. But not now, he thought bitterly. My master is dead, and I will find out what Kale knows of it. His jaw set, he started down the hallway. A short walk brought him to the door he was looking for. The servant's marking above it assured him that it led to the Chosen's audience room. He hesitated with his hand on the knob to what, he supposed, was Kale's audience room now, and had a moment of doubt. Kale was the Chosen's apprentice, after all. He was supposed to take his place if something happened to Ahriman, had been training for years for this very eventuality, and so what if Kale had been speaking with Phelan Parr? It wasn't as if the man was a criminal. The Redeemers had been around for some time, as long as Alesh could remember, and just because they advocated the worship of a different god didn't make them evil. Ahriman himself had practically said as much. They claimed that the god of light and fire was worthless, that he did nothing for the people, true. But how could Alesh fault them for such a thought when he believed it himself? Of course, they also worshipped Amidan's wife, Shira, and Alesh had no use for the goddess of the wilderness either. Neither Amidan or Shira, nor any of their children, had bothered to show themselves when his parents were killed. His hand on the latch, he wondered, as he had so many times before, why his father and mother had been on the road that day. His memories from before that night were nothing more than vague snatches of a life which wasn't his anymore. His father's laughter, his mother's soft voice singing him to sleep. The truth was, they didn't feel like his memories at all, but those of some other boy, a boy whose biggest concerns were his chores and when the next minstrels were coming to town. That wasn't him, and if it ever had been, that part of him had died with his parents. After all, he didn't even know his father's name. It was lost to him, somewhere behind that scene of blood and death. Some days he thought that if he only knew the reason why his parents had risked the darkness, maybe he could find some small measure of peace, of understanding. But all he had was the memory of their screams, of the buck and sway of the cart as it tipped over and over, and the sound of the screech and growl of the shadows in the darkness. And, of course, the scar. A reminder, if ever one was needed, of all that he had lost, of all that had been taken from him. And, just as he didn't know the reasons behind his parents' death, neither did he understand how the Nightlings could have snuck into the Chosen's castle, his stronghold, and killed him without so much as rousing a guard. And speaking of guards, he thought, just who were those three men with Erwin? The fact was, he didn't know. He didn't know why there were new guards. He didn't know why Ahriman had died. Didn't even know his father's name. He decided that he'd had enough of not knowing. He reached out, swung the door open, and stepped inside. Chapter 17
"Must go on as best we can," Kale was saying from where he sat on the Chosen's throne.
Two guards flanked him, and several others stood at the sides of the room. Alesh glanced at them for only a moment, long enough to realize he didn't recognize any of them, before his gaze drifted back to the Chosen's apprentice. Kale had changed into a rich golden doublet and black trousers, and there was no trace of the blood that had covered him. Alesh found himself thinking that blood should be harder to hide than that. So much harder. He looked at the nobles and the city's wealthiest merchants cowering in the room, huddled close together like children in the darkness. Compassion and confidence mingled in the apprentice's strong, handsome features, and Alesh was forced to admit that Kale looked noble, sitting in the throne, looked as if he'd been made for it. Which, of course, wasn't far from the truth. After all, Ahriman, a man who many believed to be the wisest person who'd ever lived, had chosen him for the task. It was his duty, what he'd been groomed for. But why, then, did a cold dread run up Alesh's spine at the sight of the man sitting on Ahriman's throne?
"But how could this happen?"
said Lord Carlyle, a heavy-set noble, in what was nearly a shout. Judging by his red, sweaty face, he had been partaking heavily of the Wheelian wine which he favoured.
"If they can kill the Chosen,"
wailed a noblewoman who Alesh didn't recognise,
"then they could get any of us. None of us are safe."
The crowd broke into nervous chatter then, the merchants complaining about what the news of the Chosen's death would do for business, while nobles demanded protection for their families, and Alesh's upper lip pulled back from his teeth in a silent snarl. Ahriman was dead, murdered in his own castle, and all these selfish fools could think about was themselves and their own profits. Kale raised a hand for silence, an amused expression on his face.
"Aren't you listening to us?"
Lord Carlyle shouted, bursting out of his chair, his face so red that he looked as if he might explode.
"Do you think this is funny?"
He stalked toward the throne, waving a meaty fist in the air, screaming curses, but he only made it a few steps before Kale nodded to one of the guards. The man stepped forward and struck the nobleman over the head with one of the weighted truncheons they all carried. There was a sickening, meaty crack, and the noble dropped to the ground like a puppet with its strings cut. The tirade of the nobles and merchants cut off in an instant, and they gawked at the unconscious nobleman, one of the most powerful of their number, in mute shock. Alesh stared, disbelieving, as blood began to leak from the wound, pooling on the pristine white marble floor. Calmly, as if nothing had happened, Kale motioned to several nearby servants, and they hurried forward, two of them straining to lift the lord and carry him out of the room, while a third wiped at the blood-stained floor with a rag. Once they departed, several seconds of tense silence passed before Kale spoke. "My people," he said, into the sudden quiet, his voice solemn. "I can assure you that I find nothing humorous about what has happened. Ilrika has lost a great leader, a great man."
"But how?"
one of the noblemen ventured cautiously.
"How could the creatures make it into the castle and attack the Chosen?"
Kale seemed to consider for a second, then,
"It is my belief that Lord Ahriman was betrayed."
There was a collective gasp from the crowd at his words, and they broke into whispers again. Kale held up a hand for silence. This time, the whispers cut off immediately, and the apprentice smiled. Perhaps it was meant to be reassuring, but to Alesh he looked like a cruel boy who has just finished beating a dog into silence.
"It is true that Chosen Ahriman was gifted with divine power from our Lord Ahmedain, but even the Chosen must sleep. I have reason to believe that some of the castle guards betrayed him, letting the Nightwalkers into the keep while he was defenceless."
The crowd began to glance suspiciously at the guards standing on the outside of the room.
"Do not fret, my children," Kale continued. "I have already seen to the matter. The guards who I believe responsible have been detained, and I have brought in good, loyal men to take their places. You need not worry about them."
Alesh glanced at the floor where, moments before, Lord Carlyle's blood had stained the white marble.
"And what of you?" he thought.
"Now," Kale said, "the Chosen will be buried, his body dedicated to the god he served."
The way he said it niggled at Alesh's mind, but the man was already moving on.
"Though it is hard, let us shed no more tears for him, for he has gone to be with Ahmedain, and even now must be basking in his divine presence. The dead are dead and beyond saving. Let us instead care for the living."
"And how are we to do that?"
a woman asked, her hand to her chest.
"The attacks are worse now than they've ever been."
Kale nodded.
Yes, but I assure you that measures will be taken to remedy that.
He scowled then, a dangerous glint in his eyes.
And you may believe me when I say that these creatures will be punished for what they have done to us. One way or the other, they will suffer for the pain that they've caused. This I promise you.
His eyes sparked as if on fire.
Ahriman was like a father to me, and he will be avenged.
Kale was just opening his mouth to say something else, when the doors opened and a grey-haired man in tattered peasant's clothing rushed inside. The nobles frowned at him and murmured to each other, apparently not scared enough to ignore a peasant acting above his station.
Chosen Ahriman!
The man paused uncertainly when he noticed Kale sitting on the throne.
Yes?
Kale asked, frowning. Apparently he didn't appreciate his speech being interrupted by some commoner. The man looked around, confused, as he wiped sweat from his brow.
My lord, where is the Chosen?
I am sorry to tell you this, sir, but Lord Ahriman was killed last night in a nightling attack.
The man recoiled as if shocked, and fell to his knees, stricken.
Yes, yes, enough of that, Kale snapped. What is your name?
The name's Bremblo, my lord. Danet Bremblo. Is it true? Is the
And what have you come to report, Master Bremblo?
It's the Redeemer, sir,
the man stumbled.
They've taken over the city square and the poor district. Folks says they even killed the guards on the walls.
There were gasps in the crowd, and Alesh felt his own stomach clench.
Surely the man was wrong. The Redeemers wouldn't dare.
Then he remembered Phelan Parr, the commander of the Redeemers, remembered the man's eyes, so cold and lifeless, yet so eager. Kale studied the man for a moment.
Are you certain of this, Master Bremblo?
The man nodded, gulping air heavily.
I am, my lord. I'm a chandler, you see. Well, I'd slept late and had just gotten to the square and was setting up my stall when it happened. First off, they was just walking through, marching and preaching like they always do. But then they pulled their weapons and started forcing folks into buildings. They was taking folks captive and blocking off the streets, killing anybody as resisted.
Sonia and Abigail,
Aless thought with a shock. They were in the square, with Corin.
And how is it,
Kale asked,
that you managed to escape capture, I wonder?
Luck is all, my lord,
the man said, bobbing his head.
Armadan's luck, and nothing more. You see, by the time I got to the square, it was so chock full of folks that I weren't able to bring my cart all the way in. Had to tie the horses at an inn a few streets over and carry everything myself. I was just now leaving the square to go back for more when I heard folks screaming. I looked back and saw the Redeemers hacking into the crowd of people, forcing them together. One of them chased me, told me to stop, but I ran as fast as my old feet could carry me, and here I am. I remember thinking how bad my luck was, getting to the square late.
He paused, wiping at his eyes.
Seems maybe I'm the lucky one, after all.
Yes,
Kale said, with a single nod.
You're the lucky one. Thank you, Master Bremblo. You may go now.
The man looked confused.
Sir?
Kale motioned, and two of the guards detached themselves from the wall, grabbing the peasant by either arm.
Make sure, he said, as they led the old man out, that he is well taken care of.
The two men nodded and led him out of the room, practically carrying him between them. The old man shot a confused, frightened look over his shoulders. Then the doors closed behind him, and he was gone. Alesh burst forward, unable to hold his tongue any longer.
Kale, you have to do something.
The nobleman turned to look at him, his expression one of surprise.
Alesh?
He asked, his surprise slowly turning into a frown.
What are you doing here?
Never mind that,
Alesh said, stepping toward the throne.
Sonia and Abigail are in the square. You have to help them. You have to.
Kale sighed sadly and turned to address the crowd.
A moment, please, my people. Alesh here was a personal servant of the Chosen, and he is overcome with grief.
The crowd immediately burst into conversation, whispering to each other about everything that had transpired.
"Kale, send the soldiers, please! Abigail and Sonya!"
Kale stood and walked forward, draping a hand across Alesh's shoulders. "Alesh, of course I'm going to do something, but we have to remain calm. We can't let our grief over the Chosen's death keep us from
night, Kale! The Redeemers are taking over the city! We have to move now!"
"We?"
the nobleman asked, in a sudden angry hiss.
"We? Perhaps you forget yourself, Alesh, but you are nothing but a servant, one who the Chosen, in his kindness, took in off the street."
One of the guards moved forward, gripping his truncheon, but Kale forestalled him with a hand.
"Do not presume to tell me what we must do.
Now, if you'll excuse me, I'm currently trying to quell a panic." He started away, then turned back. "Oh, and Alesh? Your services will no longer be required in the castle." He motioned to two nearby guards.
"See him out."
Immediately, the two guards stepped forward and grabbed him by the arms. Alesh fought free of them, and started toward Kale again.
"You weren't trying to negotiate a peace with him, were you, Kale? You were planning on—"
Something dull and hard slammed into the back of his head, and Alesh's vision erupted into bright white light, the words dying on his lips. He teetered drunkenly, latching onto the front of Kale's silk tunic.
I saw—"
Something struck him again, harder this time, and he felt himself falling down, 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 down into the waiting darkness. Chapter 18 Alesh jerked awake, his head aching like jeweler's glass that had been set out with a smith's hammer. He tried to sit up and gagged, nearly vomiting, as a wave of dizziness swept over him. He lay there for several seconds, his eyes squeezed shut, moaning softly at the sharp, throbbing pain in his head, and taking slow, cautious breaths in an effort to quell his churning stomach. Once he didn't feel in immediate danger of retching out his last meal, he eased his eyes open. Weak orange light splashed around him, illuminating a room so small that he could almost have reached out his arms and touched both walls at once. The floor was hard-packed dirt, the door a row of iron bars with a keyhole.
"The dungeons," he thought wildly. "They've thrown me in the dungeons."
Slowly, not daring to move too fast for fear that the throbbing in the back of his head would become too much to bear, he craned his neck to look out the door. The light, he saw, came from a lantern hung on a hook outside of the cell. Somewhere in the darkness, beyond the orange glow of the flame, he could hear a man's voice.
"Help me! Help me! Help me!"
Over and over again the words came, a hoarse, desperate litany, a plea for mercy that would not come. From somewhere further away in the darkness came the sound of a man screaming to be let out in a rough, cracking voice that held no trace of sanity. Soon other voices joined the chorus, and though they all used different words, their meanings were all the same.
"Help me. Kill me. Save me."
The disembodied voices seemed to drift to him out of the very air itself, the ravings of lost souls, the whispers of ghosts.
"How long?" Alesh wondered. "How long before I, too, am just another ghost? Just another voice in the darkness, begging the shadows for mercy, though even a child knows the shadows have no mercy in them."
The thought sent a surge of panic through him, and he tried to rise, but something tugged at his leg. He stumbled and fell, his head slamming into the hard-packed earth. He gasped, as pain seared through his head and body, and flecks of blackness began to dance at the corners of his eyes. Clenching his teeth so hard that they felt as if they would crack, he fought against the urge to pass out. Once the darkness receded, he glanced down and saw what had pulled him up short. His ankles and wrists had been manacled together. Carefully, conscious of the small amount of slack his bonds afforded him, he worked his way to his feet. As he rose, a fresh spike of agony lanced through his head and he grunted, stumbled forward, and barely managed to catch himself on the cell door. Using one of the bars for support, he gingerly probed at the back of his head, wincing as he did. Just how hard had the bastard hit him? He brought his hand back and saw that his fingers were wet with blood. His blood.
"Hey!"
he shouted, adding his own voice to the din.
"Let me out of here! I've done nothing wrong!"
He told himself he needed to remain calm, to think of a way to escape. But instead his mind turned to the Chandler's words, to Abigail and Sonia, going to the market square to hear the singers, to Corin, his friend, who he'd sent after them, and before he knew it, he was screaming until his voice was hoarse, his head throbbing with each rapid, heavy pulse of his heart. He yelled and threatened, begged and pleaded, and no one came. It was only him and the other prisoners. Only him and the ghosts. Finally, exhausted and overcome with dizziness, he stumbled to the corner of his cell and collapsed. He sat, listening to the disembodied voices from the darkness, begging, demanding, promising. Time passed. He did not know how long. It could have been minutes or hours. And despite his fears and his worries, an exhaustion more complete than any he'd ever felt swept over him, and he went away for a time. Chapter 19. The city burned. Flames crackled and roared, like some great storm breaking, and thick serpents of smoke rose into the sky. Timbers crashed and snapped all around him as the fire ate its fill. He knew he needed to run, to get out, but his feet wouldn't obey his commands, no matter how hard he tried. His skin burned as if it was on fire, and his throat was so full of smoke and heat that he could not draw a breath. He thought that at any moment he would die, that surely he must die. But he did not, could not. And so he stood and watched his city, his home, burn, watched its ashes float and swirl around him like soot-grey snow. Smoke was everywhere, obscuring his view, but he could make out vague human shapes running through that churning greyness, there one moment and gone the next, like restless phantoms in the world of the dead. It covered everything, that shifting sea of darkness and mystery. Or at least almost everything. It did not cover the screams. They were all around him, shrill and desperate and bereft of hope or humanity. There were other voices too, other sounds. Sounds not unlike the baying of wolves, savage and cruel and alien. Alesh started awake to a rasping, metallic sound, and he raised his head. The sounds of those screams, those hungry, demanding screams, still fresh in his mind. Four men were filing into his cell and locking the door behind them. In the flickering light of the lantern one of them carried, he saw that it was the guard from the audience room, Barak, and the others who'd stood watch with him.
"Erwin?"
he asked, confused and half sure that he must still be dreaming. But the older man avoided his gaze, and it was Barak who answered.
"I told you you'd regret fucking with me, boy."
And as he spoke, he and the others, even Erwin, withdrew the truncheons from their belts. Alesh's weariness vanished in an instant, and he jerked to his feet, backing away from the four guards until his back fetched against the stone wall of the cell.
"Erwin," he said, his voice hoarse and scratchy, "you don't have to do this."
The old man met his eyes then, and Alesh was surprised at the sadness he saw there.
"Yes, I do. I'm sorry, Alesh."
Then the men began to spread out around him, their truncheons raised. Despite his words, Erwin hung back, watching the other three. Alesh watched them come, noting the swords they had sheathed at their waists. If he could get hold of one of those, his thoughts were cut off as the men charged him, their truncheons swinging at him in vicious arcs. He ducked under one man's wild swing and caught the wrist of the second man before his blow connected. He just had time to see the man's eyes open in surprise before he punched him hard in the stomach, and the guard doubled over, gasping for breath. He caught movement out of the corner of his eye, and he jumped to the side. The truncheon, which had been aimed at his head, struck his shoulder instead. He shouted in agony, lashing out with his other arm and hitting his attacker in the face. The guard's nose snapped under his fist, and blood and snot fountained out. The man stumbled backward with a muffled cry, his truncheon falling to the ground as he cupped his broken nose in both hands. The guard named Barak growled a curse and swung his own truncheon. Alesh caught his hand and slammed it against the wall. The big guard grunted in pain, and the truncheon clattered to the ground. Alesh took the opportunity this afforded him, kicking the guard in the stomach and sending him rolling backward. He took a step toward the fallen man, reaching for his sword, a flash of hope going through his mind. If he could only get that sword! But before he'd grabbed the handle, he was jerked back as thick arms wrapped around him from behind. He struggled to break free, but his left arm was numb and weak from the blow he'd taken, and he was still struggling when Barak stood and punched him in the face. Alesh grunted as his head rocked back from the force of the blow. He kicked out desperately, but the big guard dodged it easily and waded into him, striking him in the stomach and the face with savage, cruel blows. After what felt like an eternity, the guard holding him let Alesh go, and he doubled over, falling to his hands and knees and heaving in painful gasps in an effort to get his breath back. Every part of his body screamed in pain, but he knew that if he didn't get up, these men would beat him to death. He hacked and spat out a gob of blood, and was starting to get to his feet when one of the guards kicked him in the stomach. The air left him in a whoosh, and he fell onto his side, gasping in pain.
"Stop your snivelling," Barak said, kicking the guard with the broken nose who was sitting up, moaning as he cupped his face in crimson hands.
Barak drew the sword at his waist and stalked toward Alesh, his expression grim.
"Time to die, boy."
Alesh blinked in a vain attempt to clear his blurry vision. He watched the guard raise his sword, but was too tired, too hurt to do anything about it. He winced in anticipation, but instead of the kiss of steel on his neck, something wet and warm splattered on his face. The grisly guard's eyes widened in surprise, and his own sword fell from his hands. He looked down, as surprised as Alesh, at the foot of exposed, blood-streaked steel protruding from his chest. Alesh was still trying to figure out what happened when the blade was pulled free and the dead guard crumpled on top of him. He grunted as the man's dead weight fell on him. He tried to push the corpse off, but his body ached terribly, and he could have no more lifted the man off of him just then than he could have lifted a mountain. He grunted, trying again, but the effort took too much out of him, and the darkness, which, until then, had been lurking at the corners of his vision, surged forward in a rush, and, for a time, he knew nothing. He started awake, with hands gripping his arms, shaking him.
"Get up!"
Alesh grunted, his eyes fluttering open. Barak's corpse had been thrown off of him, and a blurry, grey-haired form stood over him, holding out a hand.
"Erwin?"
he asked, in a croak. The older man nodded.
"It's me, Alesh."
The guard helped him sit up, then walked to the cell door and looked out. Using the wall for support, Alesh struggled to his feet, one hand cupped to his side where Barak's boot had struck him. He looked at the three corpses sprawled on the floor of the cell.
"You killed them,"
he said, knowing it was foolish even as he said it, but too hurt and confused for anything else. Erwin turned back, glanced at the three corpses, and nodded.
"I did. Now come on. There's not much time."
He knelt by one of the corpses and retrieved a set of keys, then walked to the cell door and unlocked it.
"Not much time for what?"
Alesh asked uncertainly.
"For you to get out,"
the guard said, unlocking the manacles at Alesh's wrists and ankles. He studied Alesh with a critical eye.
"You're covered in blood. You'll need to get new clothes as quick as you can, then get out of the city."
"Leave the city?"
Alesh asked. Since stumbling into Ulrika as a child, half mad with grief and hunger, the dried blood of his parents coating his face and clothes, he had never left, and the thought left him cold.
"Damn it," Erwin said. "Don't you get it, Alesh? The city's gone mad. Kael's denounced Armidan, claiming Shira as his goddess, and the people have followed him."
He spat.
"It's made them like animals, as like to kill you as look at you. You have to get to Valeria. Of the great cities, it's the closest. Tell Chosen Teshana what's happened. She'll send help. Get help, Alesh."
Shira, the goddess of the wilds. No, he couldn't think of that now. There were more pressing things to worry about.
"Valeria's weeks away,"
Alesh said. Valeria was the second largest of the six cities of the Chosen, and although he'd never been there, He'd seen maps in the Chosen's library that depicted the six cities of the Dawn.
"I'd never make it. The Nightlings..."
"There's no choice, Alesh,"
Erwin hissed, glancing again out the corridor.
"If you stay here, you'll be killed along with the others. You must hurry."
He reached into his pocket and produced a short cylinder of dark metal about half the length of Alesh's forearm.
"Take this."
Alesh inhaled sharply at what the man held. He hesitated, but finally reached out, almost reverently, and took the cylinder. It was heavier than he'd thought it would be. The intricate golden runes that were etched deeply into its surface felt warm beneath his fingers.
"An ever-torch," he breathed.
"But how did you—"
"Never mind,"
Erwin said.
"There's no time."
Alesh swallowed hard as he gazed at the cylinder. The ever-torches were priceless artifacts, remnants of the War of Darkness, created by Chosen Larin to help in the fight against the Nightwalkers. Larin, whom the texts commonly referred to as the Shaper, was probably the least well-known of the six, but he had created many weapons and defenses during the war, none of which were greater than the ever-torches that were said to produce a light as damaging to the night's creatures as the sun itself. None of the scholars knew what happened to Larin after the war, only that he'd disappeared after Al-Ghush and his armies had been vanquished, never to be seen again. Some argued that he'd been kidnapped and killed by Al-Ghush, or that he and Ahriman had argued, though about what, no one seemed to know, and that he'd left in a fit of rage. Of course, this seemed unlikely to Alesh, considering that the northern city of Larindale had been created in memory of the Shaper. Still others contended that he'd used up the magic Ahriman had given him in the creation of the ever-torches, thereafter becoming a normal man, assuming a different name and fading into obscurity as a normal, though exceptional, weaponsmith. Alesh ran his finger wonderingly over the tiny L inscribed at the base of the cylinder. Whether or not Chosen Larin had truly used up his gift in the creation of the ever-torches, there was no question that they displayed a craftsmanship and magic unsurpassed by anything else before or since, and that they'd been of great aid during the war. Some scholars even went so far as to say that without the advent of the ever-torches, the war itself would have been lost.
"A last resort," Erwin said. "Take this, too."
He held out a small pouch that jingled as Alesh took it. He opened it up and looked inside, gasping again. The inside of the small bag was filled with golden suns that didn't seem to reflect the lantern light so much as absorb it.
"Hire a lightbringer before you leave the city, and show no one the ever-torch unless you absolutely have to. The things will attract more attention than you'll want, and if word gets around of someone being seen with one, it won't take Kale long to put it together."
Alesh stared wide-eyed at the bag of coins in his hand, more money than he'd ever seen in one place, and most likely several years' wages for the castle guard.
"I can't take this, Erwin." "You will take it,"
the man interrupted gruffly.
"You have to bring word to the other cities of what's happened here, Alesh. You have to. And remember, find a lightbringer. It shouldn't take as much coin as that to hire one, but these are uncertain times. You hire one even if it takes every single coin, you understand? You've got a trip ahead of you, and a lightbringer is more important than food where you're going."
"The darkness,"
Alesh thought.
"He means the darkness."
The thought of leaving the city made his blood run cold, but he managed a nod. The lightbringers were men who hired out their services in escorting travelers safely across the breadth of Entana. Alesh had seen several of the men as they brought dignitaries or nobles to the Chosen's castle, and from what he'd seen, they were a grim lot. Men with hard, cold eyes. Men who had seen what waited in the darkness when the lights went out, who had seen the worst evil the world had to offer, and expected to see more before they were done. The lightbringers often carried large rucksacks slung over their backs. These bags contained common light-producing objects, such as torches, flint and tinder, and lanterns. But they were also said to hold more exotic items, such as an herbal ointment that, when rubbed on the skin, made it glow with a bright but temporary luminosity, and others that were a secret kept only for guild members. About their person, hung from their belts and jerkins, the lightbringers carried small torches, dangerously flammable herbs and roots, and other objects, the purpose of which Alesh could only guess. They also, more often than not, sported burns on their hands and arms, sometimes even their faces. The other servants of the castle had sometimes made mock of the Lightbringers and their strange appearance, but never a lash. He had seen what the darkness held, and there was something, in his mind at least, almost sacred, almost holy, about these men and women who braved its dangers. He was reminded of a book he'd once read in the library, titled The Night Wars, Bringing the Darkness to Light. The author, a bishop of Armidan, had primarily focused on the Chosen and their role in the Night Wars, but he'd confessed to little knowledge of the Lightbringers or their origins, noting only that there was said to be a time, thousands of years ago, before the Nightlings first vanished from the land of Entana, that every girl and boy were taught their ways from a young age. Whether or not it was true, the author hadn't known, but he'd went on to say that when the creatures reappeared, so too had the Lightbringers, though in far fewer numbers, and with far less knowledge than it was said they once possessed. Carefully, Alesh slipped the evertorch into the pocket of his trousers and turned back to Erwin. "Why are you helping me?" he asked. "You're supposed to serve the Chosen." The guard nodded, rubbing at his short beard.
"And so I do. I have served Ahriman for 15 years, and I will serve him always. But I will not forsake Armidan, no matter what Kael says."
He paused for a moment.
"The Chosen cared for you, Alesh. You were like a son to him, I think. Now, go.
Come with me."
The guard shook his head.
"I cannot. My family..."
He frowned, waving a hand dismissively.
"There's no time. There are no guards at the entrance right now, but it won't be long before the others come for the shift change."
He drew a dagger from his tunic and gave it to Alesh.
"Take it, and go."
Alesh nodded, swallowing hard.
"Thank you, Erwin."
The man waved a hand dismissively.
"Find Chosen Teshana, Alesh. Tell her what's happened."
Alesh swallowed hard, nodding.
"I will, Erwin. I promise."
He stepped into the shadowed hallway, walking into the darkness.
"Damn you, Kael," he whispered fiercely. "You'll pay for what you've done. I promise you, you'll pay."
He glanced back once more at Erwin, standing pale-faced in the lantern light. Then he tucked the dagger into his belt and, ignoring the throbbing aches that riddled his body, he ran. Chapter 20 Alesh ascended the stairs and was relieved to see that no guard stood watch. Cautiously, he peered out of the door, then slipped into the hallway, making his way through the servants' corridors. At his room, he crept inside and eased the door shut behind him. Then he stripped out of his bloody, soiled clothes, and was shocked to see the dark purple bruises covering his body. He hurried to dress in fresh trousers and a linen shirt, then he wrapped the evertorch in a strip of cloth and slipped it into his pocket. This done, he grabbed a bag and stowed away a change of clothes, as well as the dagger Erwin had given him. He gave one final look to the room which had been his home since he was a child. Then he turned and walked out. As he made his way out of the castle, he was surprised again by how empty the servants' hallways were. He supposed he should have been grateful, but instead the silence, the absence of the usual bustle of hurrying servants, seemed ominous, and with each step he took, the air within the corridors grew more and more oppressive, until he felt as if he couldn't breathe for the stillness, the silence. He gasped a sigh of relief when he finally merged in the stables. He crept past the stalls, wincing as some of the horses snorted and nickered, and slid through a crack in the stable doors. Outside, Alesh froze. All thoughts of stealth, all worries of being caught, swept away in shock. Ilrika was burning. Flames shot up high in the air, pillars of smoke grasping like huge, vapory fingers. Even from where he was, the smell of ash and cooked meat filled his nostrils and he gagged.
"It's burning," he thought, "just like in my dream. The whole city's burning."
"No," he thought, struggling to get control of his galloping heart, "not the whole city, only parts. In fact, the vast majority of the fires seemed to be happening in the poor quarter and the town square. The town square, where earlier that day, minstrels and jugglers were supposed to have put on a show.
the town square where Sonia and Abigail had gone.
"Corin, I'm coming,"
he thought desperately, as he broke into a shuffling run.
"Keep them safe."
The streets were alive with screams. The same street that had that morning been filled with people going about the business of living, hoping to make a profit or have a good time, was now a place of death from which all hope had faded. The smoke hung over the city, a grey veil, so that Alesh could only see a few feet in any direction, but it did nothing to block out the screams that seemed to come from all around him. Alesh stuck to the shadows as much as possible, his eyes studying the gloom around him as he uneasily made his way through the city street. He came upon two men thrashing on the ground, clawing and biting at each other, both of them bloody and snarling like animals as they fought. He made his way quickly past and was thankful when, in moments, the gloom swallowed their struggling, manic forms. He passed by several shops, the windows and doors of which had been broken out, and even now men and women were climbing out of them, carrying away goods ranging from food to clothing to jewellery, with no apparent concern for what they looted, so long as they stole something. As he watched, a middle-aged woman dropped an armful of precious jewels and necklaces, and with a savage, inhuman scream, rushed at a man twice her size who was carrying an armful of cheaply made linens. The man bellowed in feral rage, and for a moment faltered under the viciousness of the woman's attack. When he finally managed to push her off, he streamed blood from his arms and chest where she'd clawed at him, and one of his cheeks hung in a bloody ruin where she'd bitten it. She charged again, but this time the man was ready for it, and he used his superior strength to stop her charge. Then he grabbed the woman by her tousled, lank hair and slammed her head into the cobbles of the street with a wet thump. The woman's body seemed to deflate as she went still, but the man wasn't finished, continuing to smash her face into the cobbles as he growled and grunted like some hateful beast. Alesh fought back his rising gorge and turned, hurrying away.
"We were worried about the Nightwalkers," he thought, wiping a hand across his eyes,
"when we should have been worried about ourselves." He continued on in a numb haze, hopelessness settling heavy on his shoulders. Even if he did somehow manage to reach Valeria and speak with Chosen Teshana, what good would it do? How could you save people from themselves? Further on, he came upon overturned carts and carriages, their contents, what little the looters and thieves had left, spilled out onto the stone cobbles like so much garbage. Necklaces and bracelets that would have cost an average worker a year's salary lay broken and discarded as if of no worth. Handmade dresses and clothing that some tailor had spent hours of labour on lay in dirty, soiled heaps. Alesh thought that he had never seen anything quite so sad, so solid a proof of civilization's fragility. But then he saw the bodies. They lay under and around the carts, their expressions slack, their gazes dead and still, just another broken thing in a street full of broken things. At first, the dead all seemed to be merchants, men and women who'd toiled throughout the year and come to the city in hopes of making a profit, and instead finding only death, gaining only silence, the peace of the grave. As he drew closer to the city square, however, he began to see the bodies of men and women of all ages, some dressed in the simple homespun that marked them as peasants, others in the fine accoutrements of noblemen and women, their status and money scant protection against the madness that gripped the city. Staring at one broken, bloody form after the next, Alesh felt some belief he'd had about the world, about its people, bend, then finally break under the strain, a frost-laden limb snapping under winter's unavoidable truths. He'd looked away from the street and its grisly decorations when something on a nearby building caught his eye, and he gasped in disgust and horror. The man hung from the building, his hands and feet nailed to its wooden surface. His stomach had been ripped open, and his guts hung out like pink vines, dangling in stringy, bloody ropes. His skin was charred in places, as if he'd been burned, and a gaping gash had been carved in his neck, the front of his ragged shirt covered in dried blood. Alesh wanted to look away, but his eyes wouldn't obey his commands as a dark fascination took him. He'd seen the man before, hadn't he? Yes, of course he had. It had been hard to tell at first, what with the blood and the burns, but the corpse was that of the man who'd been selling nightling charms in the marketplace, the man who Abigail had scolded.
Alesha's stomach lurched, and the next thing he knew he was on his knees, spewing his guts out onto the ground in rasping heaves. The man had been a fraud, but he didn't deserve this. No one did. When his stomach finally stopped convulsing, Alesha wiped at his mouth with the sleeve of his tunic, stood on wobbly legs, and pressed on, each step taking him further into nightmare. The further he went, the worse the defilement got, as if the city had been overtaken by disease, some cancer, and the heart of it was at the town square. The bodies grew in number, until finally they were stacked on one another in small, gruesome piles. A group of what appeared to be at least 20 dead lay in a line against a wall, their throats slit. Not random killings, not this. An execution. Suddenly, he felt exhausted, was overcome with the almost irresistible urge to collapse in the street, to wait for his own death to find him. But fear for his friends drove him on, and soon he came upon the square itself. In the center, the statue of Amidan stood as it always had, the god depicted as an older man in a white robe, a torch held high in one hand, the other grasping the hilt of a sword scabbarded at his side. Amidan, the light maker. The statue had been defaced by vandals. Both of the god's eyes had been hacked out, his marble ears sheared off. Blood, and what looked like human waste, had been smeared all over the statue's surface. A blind, deaf god, Alesh thought, feeling light-headed. At least some things don't change. The statue was ringed by the corpses of men, women, and children, some of their hands still clasped in silent prayer to a god with no eyes to see and no ears to hear. Alid shuffled around the corner, searching the corpses for signs of his friends, oblivious of the tears that cut lines through the dirt and grime on his face. He was halfway around when a group of corpses caught his eye. There were five in all, and unlike the others, these wore the black and red uniforms of the Redeemers. One of them was short an arm, another a leg, and all of their faces were twisted in hate and rage, as if even death was not enough to quell their thirst for violence. Then he saw him. Corin sat with his back against the corner of a nearby alley, standing sentinel over its entrance even in death. His sword, covered in the blood of the Redeemers he'd slain, was still clutched in his fist. His blank stare turned not to where the Redeemers were, but instead toward the alley. Two more dead men in red and black uniforms lay near the big guard. His friend was covered in dozens of bloody slashes, several of which would have been mortal wounds, but his face, even now, wore a grim crimson mask of determination. Gone was his knowing smile and his easy charm. Instead, he'd become just another corpse in a city full of them, some still walking and breathing, but corpses just the same. Alesh fell to his knees beside his friend.
"God's core," he rasped. "I'm so sorry."
He decided then that the children had been right. He was cursed. If not for him, Corin would be safe, alive and well, most likely tucked away in bed with the Lady Uriel. "Find them," he'd said. "Keep them safe." The Redeemers may have done the work, but with those words he'd killed his friend. He looked at the blood-slicked blade in his friend's hand, thought of how easy it would be. A quick slice, a little pain, and then nothing. After a time, Alesh withdrew the scabbard from Corin's belt and clipped it onto his own. He reached for Corin's sword, the short, double-edged sword given as an honor to any man deemed worthy of guarding Amidan's chosen and his people. But his friend gripped it stubbornly, as if, even in death, he was reluctant to relinquish that honor, that duty. Finally, Alesh managed to pry the blade from the cold, stiff fingers. It felt impossibly heavy in his grasp, as if he hadn't taken just the sword at all, but had taken upon himself the burden of duty that went along with it. He considered it for a moment, studied the blade, the sharpness of it. A minute passed, then another. Finally, Alesh shook his head like a man emerging from a dream, and looked away from the blade and its deadly promise. The handle was in the shape of a torch, the crossguard formed by the flames that came out of it. It was the mark of Amidan, the sword a tool of his servants, and the thought was almost enough to make Alesh throw it to the ground. "It's only a blade," he told himself. "No different than the ones you trained with during your bouts with Kale."
But that wasn't true, was it? Before, when he'd been given one by the Chosen, it had been only for training, for practice. Now, he was faced with the definite possibility that he would be forced to use the sword to defend himself, possibly even to kill another person. He wondered if the blade would grow heavier as the days drew on, or, worse yet, lighter, so that eventually a man would grow used to that length of steel and its deadly purpose. The thought made bile rise in his throat. He swallowed hard, walked to a nearby corpse of one of the Redeemers, and wiped the blade clean before tucking it into its scabbard, feeling a wash of relief when the blade was out of his hands. In the distance someone screamed, but he paid it scant attention. Given time, he decided, a man could grow used to anything. It was not a pleasant thought. He examined the corpses of the Redeemers and Corin again, the numbness that had settled over him lending him an almost clinical detachment. Apparently, Corin had fought them off here, then retreated to the alleyway. He must have been dreadfully outnumbered, but instead of turning to run, he'd fought on, taking injury after injury until finally he'd fallen. "Why didn't you run, Cor?" Alesh thought sadly. "Why wouldn't you run? Unless..." His eyes widening with realization, he hurried forward and glanced down the alleyway. Shadows and darkness. No way of knowing what might lie beyond it, but he felt all too certain that he did know. A cold knot of dread building in his stomach, Alesh grabbed a torch from a nearby body, lit it using the guttering flames from one of the buildings, and stepped into the darkness. He didn't have far to go before he came upon Abigail. Her face was so badly battered that it was unrecognizable, but the dress was the same as the one she'd worn only the day before. An arrow stuck out of her back. Alesh sank onto the cobbles of the street, oblivious of the blood and the biting flies that roused and landed on him. He sat there for a time, how long he would never know. Then he screamed. He screamed out his own rage, his own hate, let it blend into some dreadful harmony with the song of the dying city around him, and for a time he knew nothing more. When he came to, he was hunkered over Abigail's body, gripping the hilt of the sword so tightly that his hand ached. "There's nothing left," he whispered harshly. "No one. Night take you," he growled, staring at the sky, glaring into that star-covered vastness where it was said Armadan sat enthroned, watching over his people. "Why can't you help us? Why?" Nothing. Only the silence and the dead. He again considered the sword at his side, thought with something almost like relief about the sharpness of it, about how quickly it would do its work. But what of Sonya? A voice in his head that didn't seem like his own asked, "What of her? She might still be alive." "She's dead," he muttered, "just like all the rest. She has to be." "If that's true," the voice said, "then where is she?" Reluctantly, he rose. It took more effort than he'd ever thought it would, but he rose just the same. She might still be alive. It was doubtful, almost impossible, but she might be. And Kale. Alesh's face twisted into a snarl at the thought, though he wasn't aware of it. Yes, Kale was alive. Him and the Redeemers, Phelan Parr and the rest. The men and women who'd brought Ilrika to this. "They'll pay," a voice inside of his head assured him. And this time the voice was entirely his own. "I'll kill them all, every night cursed one of them." Chapter 21 He'd dropped the torch and had to relight it before continuing on. If the Chosen had been like a father to him, Abigail like a mother, then Sonya had been his little sister, so full of life and innocence, so vulnerable. The finding of her corpse would, he did not doubt, push him over the edge, would make him even less than the savages that now wandered the city, killing and looting. Still, she was out there, and one way or the other, he would find her. He saw no sign of her as he walked, and after a few minutes, the alleyway emptied out onto another street, another tableau of death and fire and madness. Grimly, he examined the dozens of bodies that littered the street, and with each small child's body he turned over only to find that it wasn't her, with each desperate feeling of relief that struck him. A little of him died. He searched on, taken